Warning, Check the Locks podcast is a true crime podcast and may contain graphic descriptions of violence, murder, sexual assault, and more. Check the Locks podcast is not appropriate for all listeners. Listener discretion is strongly advised.
Welcome back to Check the Locks podcast. As always, I'm John Connor.
I'm Olivia Cornu.
Saying thank you for joining us this week as we dive into yet another truly terrifying true crime case. Before we get started, as always, Olivia, it's wonderful to see you. How are you? This is our first show of 2025. How was your Christmas? How was your New Year? I know Louisiana had some crazy stuff happening, but how are you doing?
Yeah, Christmas was good. Happy New Year to you. Overall, I'm doing okay. New Orleans was definitely struck by tragedy on New Year's Day. And so I think the city here is just trying to adjust and what that means for us and how something so terrifying can happen here. So it's definitely been a somber week in the city and, you know, just thinking about all the lives that were lost. It's been a really tough couple days.
Yeah. Well, I can definitely understand that. And, you know, it was really cool in the Facebook group. I know a lot of people were concerned, you know, because on New Year's, you never know. People go out and do stuff. So people, mm-hmm. you know, we're definitely wanting to make sure that you're okay. So if you did take the time to reach out and like check in and make sure everything was good, I was getting messages being like, hey, is Olivia okay? Like, we didn't want to blow her up directly. I was like, yes, she's fine. But yeah, it's just, you know, it's crazy that something like that would happen, especially there. I think like not that.
Yeah, that's the hard thing to wrap my brain around is that happening here.
Yeah. And not that, you know, New Orleans is like a small place or anything like that. But, you know, when you think about an act of, it's terrorism. But when something like that, you know, you would normally think, you know, bigger city, you know, like New York, Chicago, something like that. So it was definitely, it felt strange that it happened there because it just feels like that's not the kind of place that things like that happen, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. We have our own kind of crime and, you know, people who live here can get on board with that. We don't like it and we don't condone it, but, you know, it's just the world we live in. And then just to see that a true terrorist attack can happen on a corner where I've stood hundreds of times in various stages of my life and knowing that could have been anybody, that I've been on that corner at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, me too.
And I've had friends on that corner at 3 o'clock in the morning. And it's just the reality that it can be anyone is what's scary. You know, I've never felt afraid living in New Orleans. You know, if you get killed or get shot, you're just standing where a stray bullet's coming. And you know where not to be and what, you know, what not to do and just kind of keep your wits about you. But just to know that someone with that much hate and, I mean, that's just pure evil. It's very unsettling to think that a place that's so full of color and culture and vibrant and people come here to be happy and have a good time. You know, we're a city of a good time and it's just devastating to see, you know, all the young lives that were taken and still the ones that are fighting for their lives in hospitals. And it's just been a really unsettling week.
Yeah. You know, I couldn't help but think about it. I've told the story before, but like on our honeymoon before we went on the cruise, we were in New Orleans and one night I was hammered and I was like, let's go to Bourbon Street, mm-hmm. you know, and it was like 1:30, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning. So,
we've
you know,
all done it.
Yeah. So it was one of those things where it's like, oh man, like, you know, I've stood there, you know, and, mm-hmm. and yeah, I've only been the one time, but it was just like, I couldn't help but think about, you know, like people take vacations to go do stuff on New Year's and stuff like that. And, you know, especially so early in the morning, you're probably not expecting anything like that to happen, you know, and just to think that this is, you know, an act of domestic terrorism just on your front door it's got to be really strange for the people like you who live there and who are, you know, dealing with the aftermath of it and things like that. So,
no, I mean, New Orleans is small. It is one degree of separation from somebody. And I think people think it's such a big city. And that's why you just don't expect it. Like, that's our backyard. You know, the French Quarter is our backyard. And, you know, people say, oh, the locals don't go there. Yes, we do. We go to Galatoire's. We have our moments on French Quarter days and we do go to the quarter. But it's just the unsettling to think that that pure evil has not only been in our city once, but he has been here two other times prior to that. And that to me is just, it's just an odd feeling because I've never had the feeling of being afraid. And I kind of have that kind of lingering over me.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, I imagine it's very similar to, you know, living in a town where like a mass shooting happens, you know, where it's like, that mm-hmm. doesn't happen here. You know, I know
right.
that's how we felt in Nashville when we had the Covenant School shooting, where it's like, no, like that doesn't
happen here. Yeah. Not in that area.
Yeah. And so, you know, it takes a while, I think, as a community and as individuals to adjust and to kind of mm-hmm. fully process what's going on. And I do think that's one of the great things about New Orleans, you know, is especially with, you know, the history that city has faced and hurricanes and devastation. It's somehow y'all always seem to manage to still kind of like rally together and like bounce back.
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. You know? And so, you know, I think from like a resilience standpoint, if there is any area that could come back from it and be stronger and be better to each other, like I definitely think New Orleans is that place. So, you know, just, you know, if you are in that area or if you have loved ones that are in that area, just know that like, we're thinking about you and we're sending positive vibes. And, you know, this is, even though I don't live in New Orleans, I know this is something that is very much like close to home for us as a family here at the podcast. So, mm-hmm. you know, we're keeping everybody in our thoughts and hoping everybody's okay. And I'm glad that, you know, I know it's been tough, but I'm glad you're hanging in there.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I just, you know, on New Year's Day, just cried. It was just a sad day and it was just sad. It's sad for the people involved, the people who were just here for a football game, the people traveling internationally, the people, you know, working. Just, you know, it's just sad yeah. to know that 15 lives have been lost because of just pure evil.
Well, you'd text me at like 8 a.m. You're like, hey, I just want you to know I'm okay. And I was yeah. like, okay, I didn't know there was anything going on. So I immediately like hopped on my phone and I was like, what the hell? Cause you know, for people who don't know, I post in the Facebook group, but I got COVID the Friday after Christmas. So we were pretty much home all together from the Friday after Christmas up until like the last like day or so. And so we had spent our New Year's, Millie, you know, stayed up and she was like at midnight, she got out the karaoke machine and we did, you know, New Year's karaoke and sang a bunch of songs and stuff like that. But like, I'd gone to bed and had no idea anything was happening. So, you know, when I saw that, I was just like, oh my God, like that is insane. And then you see the, you know, the guy get out of the truck with the AR-15 and it's just like, what is happening? You know, it's I know we're not like a political podcast, you know, we don't get into that kind of stuff, but I think, you know, no matter what side of the aisle, like there's just something devastating to see that. And I don't know, like it was really hard to watch and, you know, to think about the families and the people who, you know, were victimized and, you know, even the people who weren't, you know, physically hurt, but were there and now have to kind of carry that with them, you know, for the rest mm-hmm. of their lives. Is like that stuff that you don't get over easily. So
no, not at all.
Well, again, we are, we're really, you know, putting our hearts and our thoughts and our well wishes out there with you. And, you know, I know you had posted some places where, you know, if people wanted to donate blood or anything like that, but is there anything else that you know of where, you know, people want to help out if there's anything they can do? Like, is there anything that you're aware of?
There's a lot of GoFundMes that are kind of circling around. Some that are more for like bigger organizations that will give out to families individually. And I've seen a few individuals who are in the hospital that have been affected and just, you know, have a long road of recovery. I've seen a couple of those. So there's definitely ways to help out with these families. I was able to go donate blood the other day and just kind of do my part because hospitals are always on a shortage of blood products and we can always use them, but especially in times of mass casualty in an area that is, you know, a trauma ridden city, like blood is a hot commodity. So it was nice to see our people show up. And I think that's one special thing about living in New Orleans is just seeing the community rally around each other and just be like, those are our brothers and our sisters and our mothers and our aunts and our uncles and our dads. And yeah, it's just so unsettling.
Well, and I will also say that the United Way has set up a relief fund as well that is going to, you know, support the victims of the attack and you know, kind of help get resources where they need to be. So if you are interested in donating, you can go to UnitedWaySELA.org. So that's UnitedWaySELA.org/UnitedForNOLA. Again, that is /UnitedForNOLA if you would like to make a donation. We'll also put it in the show notes for this episode. So if you need a cheat code, you can go click and make that donation. Because I'm sure for those the families of those victims and the victims themselves, like every little bit helps. And if you got the extra, you know, that's a hell of a way to start off your, you know, your new year, right? So if you can, you know, afford it, definitely check it out and throw a few dollars there. But again, you know, just wishing everybody the best, hoping everybody's okay. And again, Olivia, you know, glad you're okay as well. And just feel super lucky that we have the community that we have that was immediately like, hey, are people good? You know what I mean? It felt really special to be able to see people kind of rally around like that and check in, stuff like that. So we really appreciate it.
Yeah, I definitely appreciate everyone checking in.
Well, with that being said, this week, this is our first episode back for 2025. And, you know, even though it's been a heavy start to the year, I'm definitely excited to get back to it. You know, this is one of those things where we do it so much that when we take, you know, a little bit of time off, which does not happen very often, but when we do, you're kind of like, oh man, I feel weird. Like we're not, like I should be working on something. I'm not, you know, so I'm happy to be back. I'm happy to be spending time with you. This week is your case. And looks like you are using a time machine on this one, which I'm pretty excited about. So what do you say? Should we just jump into it, break down this week's case?
Yeah, this week was a little rough for me. I couldn't really get into true crime. You know, this one was kind of hard to get through, but I definitely wanted to make sure that we were coming back starting the new year, that there was no hesitations because life does have to go on. So I just kind of researched a story. So I'm just telling a story this week, a little bit different than normal, but we're going way back. Imagine a time before dating apps when lonely hearts turned to newspaper ads to find love. For some, it was a chance to act connection. For others, it was a trap. This week, I'm going to tell the story of Raymond Fernandez and Martha Beck, two people bound together by obsession, desperation, and murder. So, John, let's rewind to the 1940s. America was adjusting to life after World War II. People were looking for comfort and companionship after years of chaos. It was the perfect environment for someone like Raymond Fernandez to thrive. He was born in Hawaii in 1914, and Fernandez's life was shaped by hardship and cruelty. His parents were Spanish immigrants that later moved to Connecticut, where Raymond's father worked as a handyman. His father was harsh and unforgiving. He refused to send Raymond to school, forcing him into doing chores. The reason behind this mistreatment remained a mystery, but it set the stage for his troubled life ahead. At the age of 16, Raymond's rebellion surfaced. Alongside two other boys, he had stolen a pair of chickens. While the other boy's family paid their bail, Raymond's father refused to intervene. He left him to fend for himself, allowing Raymond to spend 2 months in jail. Now, after his release, the family relocated to southern Spain, where his father rose to an unexpected position as the mayor of their small town. However, for Raymond, the damage had already been done. By the time he was 20, he served as a British intelligence informant during World War II. He had married a Spanish woman and fathered 4 children. But Raymond's relentless spirit would not be contained. And in December 1945, he boarded a ship to the United States, leaving his family behind. Perhaps he sought adventure or escape, but fate had darker plans. While the ship sailed near Curacao, a steel hitch crashed down on his skull, causing a severe fracture. This accident left him with a scar across his forehead and, more dramatically, a change in his personality. Once he recovered from his traumatic brain injury, Fernandez became impulsive and erratic and consumed by an insatiable sexual appetite. He was released from the hospital in 1946 and quickly had a downward spiral. In Mobile, Alabama, he was arrested for attempting to smuggle stolen clothing through customs. He had pleaded guilty to the charge, but he couldn't explain why he committed the crime or why he couldn't resist the urge to steal. He was sentenced to a year in prison and sent to Tallahassee, Florida. Now, while in prison, Raymond met a man who would change the trajectory of his life. His cellmate introduced him to voodoo, hypnotism, and black magic. These practices fascinated Fernandez, offering him a warped sense of power and control. And by the time he was released in December 1946, he had become a man shaped by superstition and manipulation. Now, Raymond moved to New York City to live with relatives and began seeking companionship through a local Lonely Hearts Club.
So I'm sorry to interrupt, but I'm guessing like a Lonely Hearts Club is kind of, I guess today would be like the equivalent of like a dating app or something like that, where it's just a group of single people who are like, I want to meet somebody.
Yeah, basically. And it seemed like they paid like a small fee, like a couple dollars for membership. And this was a way for singles to get together and find those people that you're looking for. And like they said, it was in like a newspaper ad. So you would go to the ad, you'd be part of this membership, I guess, and then you would be able to meet other local singles.
Okay. So kind of like those speed dating events or like networking events, but, you know, like specifically for
in
dating.
In the 1940s, yeah.
They're all like in their flapper dresses. Oh, hey, hello, Nancy. Wow, yeah. You're a pretty young dame. Would you like to go for a cocktail or something like that?
sure, yeah.
I was born the wrong time, I'll tell you that. So. Also, I'm pretty sure that's the 20s and not the 40s, so I don't know.
Flappers are 20s.
I don't know.
We women were more of Rosie the Riveter. We can do it.
Y'all just
our
flexing.
Men were at war. Yeah.
What's up? Yeah, I built a
we
tank.
We need no men. So,
but it is kind of interesting to think about how different it is then compared to now, right? Because now it's like, you know, I want to meet somebody. I get on my phone, I'm swiping left, I'm swiping right, whatever. Where, you know, back then it's like you had to, you know, pay a couple of dollars and be forced to be in a room with a bunch of people and be social. And it's just kind of crazy how different of a world we live in now compared to, you know, and I'm sure there's still like these kind of events going on, but, you know, it's just we're so digital now. It's kind of crazy to think like, yeah, I'm going to pay $4.99 to go hang out in like a hotel lobby with 30 other people and hope I meet somebody and we hit it off, you know?
They do have speed dating things here in New Orleans. I've had friends who've gone to them. I haven't done that, but I think they also became like pen pals in a sense, but just kind of a different time to find love.
We have speed dating here in Nashville, but Kara won't let me go. She's like, it's not appropriate. Like, all right.
You're all right. A married man.
But I'm sorry, we can get back into it.
While using his charm, Fernandez crafted letters that preyed on women in hopes for love and connection. Women from all walks of life fell for his carefully worded promises and opening their hearts and their wallets to him. Unbeknownst to these women, Raymond Fernandez was no longer just a lonely soul seeking companionship. He was a predator, a man whose charm concealed a dark and dangerous purpose. And this was only the beginning of a life that would spiral into infamy. In 1946, he met Lucilla Thompson, a divorced cook who ran a New York City boarding house with her mother. Fernandez, always charming and calculating, became her tenant. Their relationship quickly turned romantic, and by October, the pair embarked on a vacation to Spain. And in a shocking twist, Fernandez introduced Lucila to his wife and children who still lived there. Now, remember, John, he had taken the ship and left Spain and just went to the U.S. by himself, leaving his family behind.
Yeah, like all good dads do. They're like,
right.
He's like, peace.
The reasoning behind the bizarre behavior was still a mystery, but tension simmered beneath the surface. On November 7th, after a heated argument, Lucila threatened to leave Fernandez and return to the U.S. alone. The next morning, she was found dead in her hotel room. The official cause of death? A heart attack. Now, Fernandez wasted no time and rushed back to New York, where he presented a forged will naming himself as Lucila's sole heir, gaining control of all of her assets. Later that year, he would meet Martha Beck. Martha Joel Seabrook was born in Milton, Florida in 1920. She was also known as Beck. She was the youngest child of an abandoning father and a very controlling mother. She was shy and bullied for being overweight. And as a child, she developed an odd sexual behavior that worried her parents. However, she would go on and graduate as a nurse in 1942. She began working at a funeral home, but it contributed to her depression and prompted her to move to California for hospital work. While there, she engaged in casual sex and became pregnant, but the father refused to marry her and he committed suicide. This made her return to Pensacola, Florida. She claimed to have married a serviceman there, but he had later died in the Pacific. She would then marry Alfred Beck in December 1944, but divorced 6 months later while pregnant. And by February 1946, she directed a residence for disabled children, but struggled with alcoholism and romantic fantasies. An acquaintance had pranked her by writing to the New York Lonely Hearts Club in her name, prompting her to meet with Fernandez. Now, he would arrange for the pair to meet, but after 2 days together, Fernandez discovered Martha was far poorer than she had suggested. He offered a silly excuse for needing to leave, and he fled back to New York City. Martha, however, was relentless. She wrote him a series of romantic letters, but Fernandez dismissed her, stating she had misunderstood him and urged her not to contact him again. Desperate to keep his attention, Martha wrote back threatening to kill herself, and the gambit worked. Fernandez invited her to New York, and Martha arrived on January 18, 1948, and kind of unannounced with her two young children in tow. Fernandez was caught off guard and refused to allow the children in the boarding home, and Martha promptly sent them to live with her mother. Fernandez was desperate to get rid of Martha and confessed that he was a con artist whose life revolved around defrauding women. And to his shock, Martha didn't leave. Instead, she pled to stay home and become his accomplice. The duo's criminal partnership began on February 28th when Fernandez traveled to Fairfax, Virginia, and he would marry a retired school teacher named Esther. Beck refused to be left behind and posed as his sister-in-law. Back in New York, Esther grew suspicious of Fernandez's motives, especially when he pressured her to sign over her insurance policies and retirement funds. She would later flee. Desperation drove Fernandez and Beck to Arkansas, where they targeted Myrtle Young, another Lonely Hearts Club member. And Fernandez married her on August 14th in Cook County, Illinois. The trio's honeymoon ended in Chicago, where tension erupted after Fernandez refused to consummate the marriage. When Young demanded Beck to leave, she was forced to ingest a jar of barbiturates. And after stealing $4,000 from her, Fernandez and Beck put her on a bus to Arkansas. Sadly, during the journey, Young suffered a brain hemorrhage and died in a hospital. Now, by Christmas, Fernandez set his sights on Janet Fay, a devout widow from Albany, New York. He used the alias Charles Martin, and Fernandez wooed her with shared claims of religious beliefs. On January 1st, he and Beck visited Janet, with Beck introduced as his sister. Within days, Fernandez proposed, and Janet withdrew $2,500 from her bank account. The three of them moved to Long Island, where she also withdrew another $3,500. But as the wedding plans advanced, Janet began questioning Charles and his sister. Beck's evasive answers stoked Janet's suspicion. An argument broke out in a fit of rage, and Beck struck Janet with a hammer, killing her. The couple stuffed her body in a chest and encased it in cement and hid it in a rented Queens basement. Now, unfazed by this, Fernandez turned his attention to Delphine Dowing, a young widow from Grand Rapids, Michigan, who had a 2-year-old daughter named Rainel. The couple, again posing as siblings, charmed Delphine. While Fernandez seduced her, Beck seethed with jealousy. And on February 27th, Beck gave Delphine sleeping pills disguised as something else. And when she passed out, Fernandez shot her in the head using her late husband's revolver. The couple buried her in the basement, but they now had a new problem, 2-year-old Rainel. The child refused to eat and cried all the time, raising fears of discovery. Reluctantly, Fernandez ordered Beck to kill her, and she drowned the child in a basin and they buried her alongside her mother. Neighbors grew suspicious of the pair's behavior and contacted the police. Fernandez and Beck initially tried to deflect attention by going to a movie theater, but when they returned home, the pair was arrested. Their reign of terror had come to an end. After their arrest, Raymond Fernandez and Martha Beck confessed to their crimes. Their confessions left little doubt, and the buried bodies of Janet Fay, Delphine Dowing, and Rainel were exhumed. The revelation sent shockwaves through the public, and the Spanish authorities were alerted to reopen the suspicious death of Lucilla Thompson. Fernandez and Beck were extradited to New York, where they each faced a single charge of first-degree murder for Janet Fay. In June of 1949, the couple entered pleas of not guilty by reason of insanity. The trial would go on for 44 days, and despite their defense's efforts, the jury found them guilty, and the judge sentenced both to die in the electric chair. As they awaited execution on death row, the relationship between Fernandez and Beck continued to evolve. Fernandez confided to a prison doctor that he held sincere affection and great consideration for Beck, but hesitated when asked if he truly loved her. When doctors relayed this back to Beck, along with the revelation that Fernandez had recently been diagnosed with syphilis, she was devastated. Yet in a final act of devotion, Fernandez sent Beck a message just 2 hours before their execution on March 8, 1951. He said, "I would like to yell to the world the love I feel for you." These words brought Beck to a measure of peace, and she told a nurse, "I'm happy to die knowing he loves me." Now, since this case, there's been several movies and shows that have been created around this 1940s tragic story. But I just thought it was something different and something I'd never heard of before. But that's this week's case.
Well, you know, I'm a sucker for these like back in time cases. And so I love the history aspect. And one thing that I was kind of looking up as you were going through, you know, because it's like, oh, she pulled out $2,500. Like she pulled out $3,500, which, you know, we talk about that in modern times. By no means is like that any like small amount of money. But when you look at, you know, the inflation. So in 1949, $3,500 was worth about $46,396 today. So
that's
a
lot of money.
Yeah.
I had to give somebody $3,500, that's a lot of money.
Yeah. It's like, I love you, I want to marry you, but you got to pull out 50 grand in 2024. You'd be like, or 2025, excuse me.
See you later.
Yeah. You'd be like, okay, something's not right. And then before that, she had pulled out $2,500. So she had pulled out close to, you know, the equivalent of $100,000.
Yeah, and his plan was to prey on these wealthier women. And that's why he was trying to get rid of Martha Beck, whenever he realized that she actually was more poor than he thought. And he was like, no, like, this is a waste of my time. You actually don't have any money.
Yeah, and it's, you know, really interesting to think of, and I'm sure, you know, now she would be diagnosed with something, but like there has to be some mental illness there to be like, no, like I love you and I'm willing to be your accomplice and also kill a child because I just need to feel like somebody loves me and like I'm useful and like I'm part of something. So it's, you know, it's terrifying. And it's, you know, to, we still have stories like this today, like, you know, like that, what was it, Dirty John or whatever. Like there are people who go out and are still doing these kind of things. And it's, I don't know. It's just, it's sad to see people being preyed upon. And these are obviously people who are lonely and want companionship. And, to think that there's somebody that's just like, oh, I can use that to my advantage and just totally screw you over is, you know, that's a special kind of dirty. You know what I mean?
Yep. If we're talking deadbolt tests, what are you thinking?
Deadbolt tests. I think this case for me is more interesting than I think it is necessary. Like, you know, I'm not worried about Fernandez and Beck showing up and being like, you know, this is my sister and we're really interested in courting you. You know what I mean?
I could have switched roles and Beck could have done the persuading.
That's true. And, you know, I just want to be loved, you know? So I think for me, I think this is probably, I would probably put this at a 3, just because, again, I'm not going to be, you know, checking my locks or, you know, this one isn't getting under my skin so much as I'm like, man, it's crazy that there are people out there who would do something like this. And then it's also, there are people out there that just want somebody so bad that they will ignore red flags because you need to feel, you know, some kind of affection or, you know what I'm saying? Like it's just, yeah. It's sad. So I think for me, I'm putting it about a 3, but what about you? Where's it going to come in for you?
I do want to say that I think it's odd and scary that in 1940s, people were committing these crimes like this, you know, that's well thought out crimes. I'm doing the same. I just thought the story was interesting and that's kind of what I was going for this week. Just a story. And, I'd say probably about a 4.
Put it at 4.
You know, it is scary as a woman who, you know, is on those dating apps. I probably would have been on the lonely love web ad, whatever it's called.
The Lonely Hearts Club.
Yes. So I'll put it at a 4.
Yeah, I think there is definitely, and, you know, I don't mean this to be like sexist in any way or anything like that, but like, I think there is a little bit of a difference as to how you would look at this. Yeah, obviously they were targeting single women, right? So like I said, as a man, I'm not really worried about them. You know, I'm like, I'm married, I'm good. But I can imagine if I was, you know, a single lady who was in that world and like meeting people, there's always got to be this like, okay, maybe this guy seems great, but you're looking for that red flag, right? You're just automatically kind of programmed to be like, okay, but where's the thing that I'm missing? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And you know, I can imagine too, for some of these women who like figured it out, like just being like, oh, I feel so duped. You know what I mean? And like, once you realize you've been taken advantage of, there's got to be like an immense like feeling of guilt and like, well, how did I not know this? You know what I mean? So I can imagine that probably be pretty hard to deal with. Well, that is where we fall on the deadbolt test for this week's episode. I'm putting it at a 3. Olivia's coming in at a 4. But as always, we got to throw it out there to the locksmiths, the listeners. Where does the story of Raymond Fernandez and Martha Beck fall on your deadbolt test? You can let us know. Reach out to us on Instagram at Check the Locks Pod. You can find us on Twitter at Check the Locks. If you're not in our Facebook group, what are you doing? Come hang out with us. We would love to get to know you, spend a little time with you. You can let us know what you think of the cases. Again, it's just a great way for us to interact. We're in there all the time, and we would love for you to be part of that community. You say it all the time, but it's the best place on the internet. So if you'd like to join, there is a link in the description of the episode you're listening to right now. Go ahead, click that link, fill out a few questions, and come hang out with us. We'd love to have you as part of our little Facebook family. And Olivia, it is 2025. I say this year is the year that we hear from our listeners the most. So we love to hear reviews. We love to hear voicemails. We love to hear all sorts of stuff. Olivia, if somebody wants to leave us a review that we can read on the show, what is the best way for them to do that?
They need to go to the Apple Podcast app, go to our show's homepage, scroll down where you see all 5 of those stars, click the stars, and tell us what you think.
That's right. And Olivia always says it best so that I don't have to. That's Apple Podcasts. Click the show, leave that review. Let us know what you think. We would love to read those reviews. Also, we love hearing from you. So again, 2025, we want to hear from you. You can call in and leave us a voicemail. Give us a call at 615-920-9393. Again, that is 615-920-9393. That is toll free in the United States. So give us a ring. Let us know what you think. Leave us a voicemail on that voicemail line. We would love to hear from you. Also, if you're out of the country or you just don't feel like dialing the number, you can leave us a voicemail at checkthelockspod.com. Click the little voicemail icon. You can leave us a message anywhere in the world. You can also leave Spotify comments or just send us an email at contact@checkthelockspod.com. Again, we want to hear from you. What do you think of the show? What cases should we do? You know, what do you like? What do you not like? Anything you got, we want to hear from you. So smoke signals, email, however you want to do it. We would love to hear from you. And as always, if you like what we do, you want to help financially support the show, you can do so by becoming a patron. Head over to patreon.com/checkthelocks and get signed up today. We got a lot of great tiers, exclusive benefits. You get stickers, coffee mugs, all sorts of stuff. Plus, you get the episodes ad-free. So if you love Check the Locks, but you hate those commercials, Patreon is the way to go. So again, you want to help us out, throw us a few bucks. That is patreon.com/checkthelocks. Get signed up today. And if you can't financially support the show, we definitely understand. Just listening and hanging out with us, sharing what we do with your friends, your family, the people who are important to you, means just as much, if not more. So if that's you, you're telling people to listen, sending them links, things like that, just know that we appreciate that so much. Again, that's going to help us grow, bring new listeners in the community, and really just help the show to expand. So from the bottom of our hearts, if you are sharing this, just know we appreciate you more than we could ever tell you. That is all that we have for our very first case of 2025, but please make sure that you are subscribed to Check the Locks on your favorite podcast app so that you never miss an episode. We will see you again next week with another truly terrifying true crime case, but until then, don't forget to
check the locks.
See you next week.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.